Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books and Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Our guests for the episode, Dr. Carol Owens and Dr. Stephanie Swales, and they join us for part one of a two-part interview for their new book, Psychoanalyzing Ambivalence with Freud and Lacan, On and Off the Couch, first published 2020 by Routledge. Dr. Carol Owens is a psychoanalyst and clinical supervisor in private practice in North Dublin. She is the founder of the Dublin-Lacan Study Group. She was editor of the journal The Letter, Perspectives on Lacanian Psychoanalysis from 2003 from 2007. She is the series editor at Routledge for the series Studying Lacan's Seminars. She's published articles and book chapters in the field of Lacanian psychoanalysis and at its junctures with critical psychology, queer theory, film theory, cultural studies, and critical management theory. Dr. Stephanie Swales lives in Dallas, Texas, where she is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Dallas, a practicing psychoanalyst, a licensed clinical psychologist, and a clinical supervisor. She is the founder of the Dallas-Fort Worth Area Lacan Study Group and recently served as the president of the Dallas Society for Psychoanalytic Psychology. Dr. Swales is on the executive board of the Dallas Postgraduate Program in Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy. She is the author of numerous articles and book chapters on the theory and practice of Lacanian psychoanalysis, in some cases, as it intersects with critical psychology and cultural studies. Dr. Swales, Dr. Owens, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So we begin all of our episodes with the question, what motivated you to write the book? And in this case, what motivated you to write the book? And then how did you come to write it together? Dr. Owens, why don't you start us off?
Well, hi. Thank you, Christopher. That's a nice question. So Stephanie and I met at a conference some years ago, and almost immediately decided that we just had so many things to talk about together about our practice and about the things that we were reading. And we even at the same time had a supervisor in common. So very, very quickly, we came up with a couple of ideas that we thought would be interesting to think about working together as a project. We weren't really sure where the project would lead. But as we began to develop more and more ideas about this particular concept, which was this old psychoanalytic concept, ambivalence, we got more and more excited and the ideas just began to flow. In terms of how, I would say that's the subject, and I know Stephanie will be smiling at this, it's a subject which has been a kind of source of intrigue for a lot of our friends and colleagues over the years, who've become just really quite curious about how the writing process was carried out and how we developed our ideas together. And I don't know, Stephanie, you want to say something about that too?
Oh, sure. Well, as you mentioned, you know, really quite quickly upon, you know, meeting each other in person, I had read, you know, some of your work previously. We decided let's work on something together. And I had never co-authored anything with anyone before. And, you know, in hindsight, it certainly seems like a risky endeavor because, you know, working together, and especially the way that we do, can be challenging. But it's just really worked out. I guess our intuitions were right. You know, I know some people manage being co-authors by writing, you know, each one will write a certain part of the argument, or, you know, go chapter, switch off chapters. But Carol and I, you know, talked every week about our ideas, and, you know, certainly one of us would take the lead on this or that area of the book. But, you know, we always, you know, wrote and rewrote what each of us had written to the point where I really can't tell anymore who wrote what. It's very difficult. And it's just been lovely. You know, Carol's a very dear friend, and, you know, she and I are kind of, you know, we do have other friends, but when we go to conferences together, you know, people make fun of us for, you know, being, you know, being together so often, and
yeah.
Right. But in a nice way, hopefully.
That's right.
We certainly enjoy it.
We do. We've had a lot of fun with it.
Well, it makes sense that we need two people to write about ambivalence.
Exactly. Of course. That's what we said.
Yes.
Exactly.
So let's start right out of the gate with that. Which is, I worked years ago with a guy who used to joke, his you know, sort of his cocktail party joke was, I've got mixed feelings about ambivalence. But you state clearly that ambivalence is not mixed feelings. So for the purpose of the book and for the podcast today, what's the definition of ambivalence?
Sure. So, it's hard since I can't see Carol. We can't decide which of us is going to speak first. Mixed feelings tends to imply that, you know, both are very much accessible at the conscious level. You know, but for us, instead, it's, you know, essentially takes us back to Freud and Freud's initial conception of, you know, where one current is conscious, the other is unconscious. Two are equally, the two currents are equally strong, but they're localized in the subject's mind in such a fashion that they can't come up against each other.
Yeah.
You know, there it's, you know, the affect can be, you know, split off, and the associated affect of the repressed idea and transformed or displaced. You know, it's something that evades our conscious perception, something about our experience.
Just to
add that, you know, that makes ambivalence kind of essential operation of the human experience, insofar as, you know, if we're subjects with a conscious and unconscious processes, then by definition, ambivalence is at the core of subjectivity. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I was just gonna add a couple of things, but absolutely. What you said, Christopher, this kind of commonplace understanding of, I think, yeah, I mean, if you went out in the street and asked people what, you know, what does ambivalence mean, they would probably say something like, well, you know, to feel at least a couple of ways about something or another. And And that's just it. I mean, that is, you know, you wouldn't say to that person, well, you're wrong. It doesn't mean that. It clearly can mean that at the level of, you know, popular or common understanding, common discourse, you know. It's interesting, I think, that Stephanie and I, you know, we had a couple of different subtitles in mind for the book. Eventually, this one, you know, came, it said it better, what we wanted to capture in the book. But one of the subtitles that I really liked, but that wouldn't have worked for American readers, was I wanted to use the expression "in two minds about it." Okay, so you know that as a subtitle. And Stephanie said, "Well, we can't use that because it doesn't really mean anything. Like we say of two minds," and immediately it was like, "Good grief." You know, this idea of there being two minds is exactly the kind of conundrum that Freud himself resolved when he was talking about ambivalence. You know, that initially, you know, he had to think about and theorize ambivalence as about, let's say, two different people. In other words, love for the mother, hate for the father, in the kind of Oedipal version of ambivalence. But later, he situates both the love and the hate just in different places in the subject's mind. So it's kind of interesting that the very title of the book already, if you like, you know, challenges and gets right to the core of, let's say, the difference between our everyday understanding of ambivalence and the psychoanalytic understanding of ambivalence. And it was definitely something that we wanted to cover. In fact, we wanted to say something about both, but being psychoanalysts, we wanted to privilege the psychoanalytic understanding.
You say somewhere, and I've read the book, but then I've also attended papers you've given, so I'm not sure if this comes out of the book or those, but the idea that the core of the book came out of the clinic. So it's on and off the couch. Let's start on the couch. What came out of the clinic? What were you seeing, listening to, experiencing?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it always starts with the clinic. It has to. When you hear about ambivalence, somebody doesn't come in and say, listen, I'm feeling ambivalent. What they talk to you about is their intense feelings of love and hate, their stories of friendship and enmity, the tragedy of mourning, the challenges of adolescence, the difficulties of motherhood and maternity. And it's absolutely in every moment of the transference. So, you know, it's ambivalence isn't presented usually as a symptom on the couch, if you like, if anything. And certainly I've always thought about it this way, and I know that Stephanie and I were absolutely in agreement about this when we first started talking about it, was that in fact, moving towards the articulation of ambivalence in the clinic is restorative. It, in fact, presents the subject, presents the patient with a way to move forward. That's the clinical aspect.
And I would, I think well said, Carol. And I mean, it's just everywhere in our practices. And I would add to your last sentiment there that you know, a patient's presenting problem, you know, might be, you know, I just want to, you know, get that promotion, but I can't seem to make myself work harder or, you know, get to work on time even, you know, so on and so forth. And so they, you know, they think that they want to figure out how they can work harder and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, when there's some, you know, conscious desire to do something, but yet it's belied by their, experience and their actions and choices, you know, there's something else there, some other force, then, you know, ambivalence is typically lurking there, you know, some ambivalent attitude toward a parental figure, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, the subject's success or lack thereof, or choice of career, things like that. And so, you know, they're within, you know, what we might call symptoms or presenting problems, but they have to be unpacked. And it's through this unpacking and, you know, working through that, that the treatment really moves forward.
And again, and I think it's important to say, and I, this is sort of imminent in perhaps what we've already said, but that, you know, we never would think of ambivalence as a symptom. So at the same time, and, you know, I think we chatted about this briefly earlier, Christopher, that, you know, what ambivalence, if you like, is and I would say always is, following Adam Phillips, is that it's an index of what is most important to the subject, to the patient, without, and as Stephanie has just pointed out, without their being aware of the importance. So, you know, where one, let's say for where one, you know, strong emotion is expressed, you know, whether it's hatred or jealousy or envy, you know, what cannot be accessed, what absolutely cannot be reached, is the other pole of that emotion. And this is where, I mean, in many ways you come across this when you're dealing with someone in a state of profound mourning, where they have elevated the, you know, the lost object, we would say, that the dead person, whoever the beloved person was, they have elevated them to the, you know, to the level of you know, saintliness, to the level of godliness almost. You know, this person could do no wrong. They were wonderful. I don't know how I'm going to live without them. They never, you know, they never put a foot wrong. This wonderful person now, and gradually over time, working with that person and allowing them to work through the tensions of their ambivalence, of course, what they can come around to realizing is, well, you know, maybe they weren't that wonderful. And I miss all of that. I don't just miss the wonderful bits. I also miss the less wonderful bits. But these less wonderful bits cannot be spoken about because the tension of the expression of the tension of ambivalence, it catches us. And that's, I suppose, one of the huge arguments we make in this book, is that when the tensions of ambivalence cannot be expressed, in other words, whether they are either unconsciously negated in some way, repressed, we would say, but also we can use other terms like foreclosed or disavowed, in some way not allowed, we can say, then what we know as psychoanalysts is that, you know, it pops up somewhere else. And this is a huge argument, like a main theme that we work on throughout the book. And that's why we use unusual figures, and I know that you want to get there later, Christopher, but that's, you know, that really is, you know, it starts with the couch. What cannot be expressed, what is repressed, it finds its way out elsewhere. And you find it in client dreams, and you know, especially those who have lost, you know, we talk about that a lot, you know, when you have someone who has lost someone, that you know, that dead person will appear in dreams and is often indicative of where the person is in their mourning, you know? We could say more about that, if you like, later on.
Well, I was thinking about when you're talking about the person in the mourning, and eventually they say, well, you know, I also, you know, have this memory and that it's not accessible to them. I had an experience of that inaccessibility in what seems like a shocking question, where a patient said to me, "This said, can I tell you something personal?" They said, "Can I tell you something personal?" And that's what I was like, yes, but I realized that that as they begin to access what had been inaccessible, that felt more personal than yeah. than what had been talking about before.
Sure.
It was a wonderful moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they needed, you know, asking permission of me.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That you would. Yeah, exactly.
And all too often that comes forth in the transference, you know, you must be thinking that, yeah. you know, that the thing that they are ashamed of or wish they hadn't thought comes out through you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Carol, you mentioned foreclosure, and foreclosure is goes throughout the book. Let's get off the couch because let's get off the couch. And I want to read something that was in one of the endorsements of the book. Todd McGowan mm-hmm. says, ambivalence is perhaps the central category in social relation in an era characterized by refusing ambivalence, which is refusing the price of interacting with others all together. I guess to take it off the couch, asking a question you ask in the book, what are the symptomatic effects on the individual at the social level of foreclosure in everyday life?
Well, this is a really big question. It's like the whole of the rest of the book. Okay. Right, so let's see. So chapter one, no, just kidding. I'm gonna come at this by making reference to, of all things, zombies. Because it's what occurred to us, almost straight away when we began to think about what are the consequences at the level of the social, at the level of the social bond, as Lacan would say, keeping the expression of the tensions that accompany ambivalence, of keeping them, we could say, off the stage. Okay. And that's another concept that we use a lot throughout the book, the idea of staging the tensions of ambivalence, because we felt, and we, you know, looking at all of the different, I mean, we use a lot of, we refer to a lot of TV, a lot of film, both mainstream and otherwise, to things which, if you like, come to represent the kind of, I suppose, we can say that the cultural pulse, you know, on or about something which gathers momentum and has a bit of heat. So I suppose, you know, we were struck, I always give credit to, and I know Stephanie will approve of this, but we always give a little bit of credit here where it's due to one of my own kids, because when, you know, we started to talk about, working in ambivalence, and my youngest son said, well, you should watch The Walking Dead. It's all about that, you know? I said, The Walking Dead? Like, what the hell? This is like a show about zombies, right? And, I hadn't watched it. Stephanie hadn't watched it. I was like, well, Stephanie, apparently we have to watch The Walking Dead. It's all about ambivalence, right? So we gave it a shot. And it was like, oh, my God, of course. Because what is represented, and obviously there will be people listening to this who will go, well, don't tell me what The Walking Dead is about. And it's definitely not about psychoanalyzing ambivalence. But actually, though, what it does represent is the kind of tatters of the social bond, you know, what is left after the love has gone, so to speak, because you're left just with hatred, you know. And we, of course, and there are so many people commenting on the whole genre of zombie film production and zombie TV show production. Since the very beginning, back in the 1930s,
the zombie has been a kind of stand-in for what is, you know, not wanted in the social bond, whether it's the, you know, homeless, out of work, destitute American worker on the streets following the crash of the late 20s, or the other version, which, you know, comes from, the tales of Haiti, from, you know, the kind of the voodoo zombie in the stories of Haiti. So again, you know, the something of the oppressed or destitute, unlovable, who could say, neighbor. And this was a theme that really struck us because we thought, oh, good grief. At the level of social interaction, at the level of culture, what is really most difficult for us if we cannot express the tension of our ambivalence is how do we, on the one hand, love our neighbor, you know, get along with them just fine, considering them in all of their potential otherness. How do we do that on the one hand, when, on the other hand, according to the dictates of neoliberal capitalism, actually our neighbor is our biggest rival for, well, you name it, just about anything. So that was really something that struck us, that when you look at all these, you know, the production of zombie films, you see people really enjoy seeing zombies' heads being blown off. They really enjoy, and you know what? There isn't a millennial alive who cannot tell you the most effective way to destroy a zombie. And that should have so much cultural currency, you know, is both striking but also begging to be interpreted. And so that's one of the things that we do in order to explain how ambivalent tensions run riot and can find no other representation, or at least little adequate representation, except through these, the use of these unusual undead figures that we claim are stand-ins for the difficult neighbor that we really find most difficult to love.
I'd just add to that, and emphasize that, the zombie, ever since its inception on the screen of varying sizes, has served an allegorical function. Giorgio Romero's famous trilogy, features, racism and, consumerism. That's a theme which we've found throughout the 20th and 21st century. Vis-a-vis this question of foreclosure of ambivalence, that you were asking about, Christopher, our argument related to that vis-a-vis the figure of the zombie, which, Carol very well articulated, is, we see the zombie as representing our symblob, the figure of the neighbor who is, too close for comfort and, different from us in some kind of threatening way. We traced, certainly we didn't subject ourselves to a horrible movie marathon of all the zombie films and things, from the 80s on, but we did.
Oh, I don't know. We did a fair bit. we did more than we thought we would. Yeah.
True. Yes. Especially myself not having previously been a fan of the genre, but we saw from the beginnings of the zombie on the screen through to the late 80s that the zombie appeared most frequently as a kind of monstrous figure from beyond the grave or beyond our world as some kind of, you know, supernatural conjuring. And so that suggested to us that, you know, the undead zombie as our roused dead neighbor was the zombie materialized in the real, the order of Lacanian real, as a kind of retribution, punishment for human beings tinkering and meddling with the laws of God, of nature, you know, where they shouldn't. In that era, we saw some more the foreclosure of ambivalence in the symbolic, which led to the return of the ambivalence in the real that's materialized in this figure of the zombie. And we found interestingly that especially post 9/11, becoming a zombie was most often figured as the result of some kind of infection, some mysterious virus or plague, people meddling with scientifically with viruses, chemicals. Of course, that sounds pretty on the nose right now with living with COVID-19. In various parts of the world that are more in lockdown than my state currently is for, I was going to say for better or for worse, but I think it's for worse personally. That's made a kind of desert of our streets. Certainly has altered social life as we know it, and maybe a bit reminiscent of these post-apocalyptic scenes and zombie films. But
totally,
So post 9/11, then we're saying that we see the disavowal of ambivalence or the denial of ambivalence has produced a kind of perverse figure, the zombie next door, as your next door neighbor, basically. So, certainly the foreclosure of ambivalence in our times is operative alongside the disavowal of ambivalence. But just to continue this theme, we saw a kind of shift in the zombie representations on the screen that clued us into maybe something of the dominant way to excise ambivalence in society at different times.
Mm. And I think that, and maybe just to even say the last, something, I suppose the last word that we have in the book about the zombie is that, if you look at the most recent use of the zombie, and even if you've seen the film World War Z or World War Z, as you would say, I told Christopher that you were teaching me American, so you see these swarms of zombies moving at high speed, traveling, using, standing on each other's heads to, in an apparent cooperative gesture to take something over, to infest it, to devour it. And these can be nothing other than, allegories about, the fears that have prevailed in all parts of our world in recent times, especially in recent times, about, the fear of being invaded by the undesirable other, who's just going to, break over our borders, attack us, and take what's ours,
immigrants,
and enjoy it.
Various sorts.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And enjoy at our expense. So there's it's a fascinating figure, the zombie, and
I'm quite sure there's lots more mileage to be gotten from using the zombie in that way. But it's not the only figure that we look at in the book. And we also look at, you know, we look at vampires, we look at other characters and other monsters, but particularly useful.
And people.
Monsters. Well, I was thinking of Trump, you know, is it okay to say Trump is a monster? Is that okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. But we do look at that too. We look at, you know, politics, trick fairs, and, you know, zombies. So.
And just to add as well quickly that, you know, we don't see that, you know, so certainly it is true that we can view these, you know, zombie, for instance, representations on the various sizes of the screen nowadays, maybe just a small screen nowadays, as representative of something of our ambivalence at the moment, whatever the, you know, whatever it is that's going on culturally, whoever the figure of the degraded other might be, you know, racialized other or immigrant other, you know, so on and so forth. But we don't see that these kinds of representations actually help us work through our ambivalence.
Exactly.
So they sort of, you know, they function to represent them, but they don't help us resolve the tensions of ambivalence far from it. And so, you know, while we can see that there's a lot of enjoyment in this kind of weak staging of our ambivalence, and I would add as well, you know, video games certainly do the same thing. All the violent killings that go on in video games, you know, it's not as though we're coming out the other end after watching however many seasons of The Walking Dead there are now, you know, all tidied up and, you know, our unconscious has been made conscious. And we now have a better relation with our neighbors.
Yeah, and I think, is it okay to say a little bit more about this, Christopher? Not about zombies, but just about this whole idea of, you know, how things are put on the stage for us in order to, let's say, represent our tensions of ambivalence.
Oh, yes.
Because
staging goes throughout the book, and you say through different epochs. I think you talk about Henry VIII.
But more and less directly about Henry VIII, but more about the representation of Henry VIII. And again, why not? Okay, so Henry VIII. I mean, it's so interesting, right? That, you know, 500 years ago, this guy, but we are still making movies, we're still making TV shows. Why? You know, why? Why the hell is he so interesting? And, well, we think he's interesting because he brings something out every single time, the fascination about why, you know, he moves, you know, so dramatically from one pole of his ambivalence to another. First, you know, and he does it six times in a row, you know, and that's what makes it so riveting. Not just that, but also that he has to be, if you like, he has to persuade, you know, in various ways. He has to make very powerful his conviction of the thing which was previously so libidinally charged as desirable has now fallen to a completely different kind of situation and must be disposed of. And of course, when that happened in Henry VIII's time, well, it usually ended on a particular kind of stage, usually with someone bearing an axe. So we thought that, you know, there was something, in a way, these, you know, zombie killings and zombie massacres, somehow, you know, that there is the same kind of appetite for a zombie killing as there is in the viewer, the spectator, when, you know, wanting to see exactly how sharp was the axe that was, you know, brought to the block by that very highly skilled executioner who was hired to kill Anne Boleyn. Our fascination with that kind of detail certainly seems to indicate that, you know, the need for us to see something staged of this, you know, particularly in this case, hateful aspect of someone's ambivalence. Now, what I was going to say actually was that, you know, if you take someone like Bruno Bettelheim's work, you know, where he wrote, you know, so well about the constitutive aspect of ambivalence in the young child's development, in the psyche of the young child, that, you know, it was essential for, let's say, a child to, you know, see and hear about figures who, in fact, were not at all ambivalent figures. They were good or they were bad, you know, not good and bad at the same time, but actually there were the good guys and there were the bad guys, and that this was certainly a characteristic element of, you know, traditional fairy stories and fairy tales. But if you look at the kinds of children's literature that prevails, especially for young children nowadays, they are completely, you know, washed out figures, emptied of jouissance and desire and of the kind of muddy complexity of ambivalence. And this is, again, something that, you know, Stephanie and I were really struck by, because there was, at the time that we were writing, I think it was in its sixth or seventh season, the Netflix TV show Once Upon a Time, which brought together all of these fantastical characters who were, I suppose, in some ways, derivative of, you know, quite classic fairy tale heroes and villains. But unlike, you know, the kind of stories that Bettelheim viewed as, you know, essential for children to read in order to work through the psychical gap that exists between their feelings about the good guys and their feelings about the bad guys, in this TV show Once Upon a Time, the person who was the good guy in one season, in the next season, comes back as the bad guy. So it really kind of suggests that, you know, contemporary viewers are incapable of tolerating the kind of psychical gap between the good and the bad, that they just can't manage it. So we won't put them through that kind of distress, you know. We'll make sure that the good guy this season comes back as the bad guy the next season, and there we are, all tidied up. It's a very strange thing to do, you know.
Well, you mentioned in that the idea of jouissance, which is also a big part of the book, so I wanted to get to it. And you were mentioning about the other, the racialized other, the animal other. And you write in the book that ambivalence about one's own jouissance is at the very roots of xenophobia. Can you explain that?
Sure thing.
Sure. So, yeah. you mentioned, Christopher, that some of the listeners might not be familiar with the concept of jouissance.
Yes. We need to do that first.
So, you know, like many of Lacan's central concepts, it shifts in various ways throughout his work. It has different significations, but for our purposes, I think it's helpful just to think of it as being similar to Freud's concept of libido, and being a kind of embodied pleasure or enjoyment that typically involves some level of excitement or is mixed up with pain and suffering to varying degrees. So, you know, speaking of zombie films, like the jouissance, the pleasure that one might get from watching a zombie film, you know, getting scared, being disgusted, you know, things like that. Jouissance in complaining, from orgasm, from one's symptom. And, you know, it is a kind of enjoyment or satisfaction that makes us return as subjects to certain modes of jouissance again and again. So you can see, you know, characteristic of each person are their ways of, you know, deriving jouissance, ways of getting off. And a lot of those ways, that person, if you ask them, you know, do you enjoy this? They'd say, absolutely not. jouissance, though, can't be repressed because it's, it's a bodily experience, but it can absolutely be denied or misrecognized. And, you know, we see jouissance at the center of symptoms, of repetition compulsion. I don't understand why I keep doing this, things like that. That being said, I think, so your question is, again, Christopher, about hatred of the neighbor. Could you rephrase that one more time?
Extremacy, wasn't it? He asked about
it. I think in the book it's ambivalence about one's own jouissance is at the very roots of xenophobia.
Absolutely.
And then also hatred of the other's jouissance. So
extremacy is, I think, a really fabulous Lacanian concept. It's essentially at its root, you know, the idea that the very core of our experience is of the other. So the intimate, you know, what we believe to be most unique, most intimate to ourselves has its roots in the other, inextricably linked with the other. And so, you know, it has various, you can see this in various ways in Lacan's teachings, from the simple, our desires are formed by others' desires. We, you know, identify with them, take them on as our own, put our own spin on it, or we disidentify with it, which is, the same link. No, I'm not going to be like my mother. Our egos are formed through identifications with others, and as we're highlighting here, our jouissance is formed in relation to others, I'd go back a bit to say that what it is that is at the root of our intolerance of the figure of the other, the neighbor who threatens us, who arouses our fear, our hatred. It's based on jouissance. And so, this explains why, there's no level of logic of words that can, dissuade someone from a racist position, for example. You can't just explain away, why this other person is wrong and have them say, oh, wow, thank you so much. I'm totally changed now. Because racism and other forms of intolerance of the other, of xenophobia, is based on what we call an extimate ambivalence about our own jouissance. So I'll try to explain this quickly, and I'll let, Carol chime in. Essentially then, what really bothers us about the other is, the way that the other enjoys in terms of jouissance. Our hatred of the other's jouissance has a important structural cause, which is that our, the path to subjectivity entails. We could think of the psychoanalytic term castration. We all are socialized into various ways of giving up certain pleasures. No, you can't, cling to mommy anymore. You've got to be potty trained. You can't just go whenever you want. You have to share, things like that. So there's a kind of relinquishing of jouissance that occurs in order to enter into subjectivity. And we see, that the other, the big other, whoever represents that for us, culture is demanding it from us. So we then forever see it as a kind of sacrifice we've made of our jouissance and given over to the other. Mm. This sacrifice is represented, in Freudian terms by the lost object, in Lacanian terms by the object A, the petit objet A. And then we're forever fantasizing afterwards, that if only we could, obtain the object, then we'd be truly whole, truly happy, everything would be fine and dandy. But of course, what we misrecognize is that the object is not an actual object. There's no object that corresponds to that loss. We never really had it. We never really had this state. And so, so since we see it as having been stolen by the other, through the lens of ressentiment, of sour grapes, we then hate the other's jouissance, because we see it, we tend to perceive it in this kind of perversely excessive manner, they're enjoying themselves too much or indecently, that they're wrong somehow to enjoy in the ways in which they do. In that way, we're locked into a kind of essential ambivalence about the other's jouissance, because in our hatred of it, we're actually claiming it as our own. We're saying, that's lost. That's my jouissance. It's loved then by us. Essentially, go ahead, Carol. I have a few other thoughts, but yeah, you chime in and then.
Well, look, you've said it all there, Stephanie, really, but I think that it's the crucial point to kind of, and you've said it two or three times in a way that it's to kind of hit home this idea that, their jouissance is our jouissance. It cannot be anything else. Insofar as we believe we've been robbed of something, that is what, of course, then retroactively makes it our own. How could we be robbed of something unless it was ours to be robbed in the first place? So if the other, whatever that other is or how it's constituted, if they are enjoying at our expense, it is because they have stolen what we would enjoy if we could. And this is the, Christopher, you kind of made the, you posed the question about the link between xenophobia and, the dehumanizing of the other, the making of the other an animal. We quote Trump, talking about people crossing over the border, and he's saying, these aren't people, these are animals, and we're taking them out of the country now, faster than ever before. So this way to speak about the other as an animal is nothing. It's not like an old thing that we don't do anymore. No, it's still something that people do. This is how people describe the other. So I suppose what we've done is we've been reading, Derrida, especially from his book, The Animal That Therefore I Am, where he talks about an immense disavowal, and we read Derrida with Lacan to kind of say that, well, look, speciesism is a paradigmatic disavowal upon which human identity is based, you know, and that in order for any kind of xenophobia to begin to be overcome by the subject, it's going to be necessary to see oneself as one is seen by the other in his or her absolute alterity, and then to accept that strange beast within. So that, you know, this is what we're trying to bring out as this ultimate little shift of how, in fact, what we suffer from most is our own, well, we say it actually in our afterword even, what we suffer from most is our own disgusting jouissance, that both is, you know, what is most hated in the other as something which is robbed from us, and yet we cannot, in fact, find any good terms to be on with our own, what we find, our own disgusting jouissance.
And I think, you know, further that, you know, when in the clinic, when we see people, you know, whatever their various prejudices may be, are revealed through dreams or just their everyday discourse, it says, you know, the way in which they hate the other jouissance says something about their own jouissance. So I think it's a useful thing to keep in mind in clinical work as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is the end of part one of our two-part interview with Dr. Stephanie Swales, Dr. Carol Owens, and their book, Psychoanalyzing Ambivalence with Freud and Lacan on and Off the Couch. Part two of this interview up next.